Welcome to this edition of Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host for this episode, Dr. Sarah Weiss from Atlanta, Georgia. And today I'm joined by Dr. Naweed Chowdhury from Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Dr. Chowdhury is an author on the recent IFAR publication, Long-Term Particulate Matter Exposure May Increase Risk of Chronic Rhinosinusitis with Nasal Polyposis, Results from an Exposure Match Study. And we'll be discussing this paper today. So welcome, Naweed, and congratulations to you and your co-authors on the publication.
Awesome. Thank you so much for inviting me to be on the podcast, and really excited to talk about our work and our paper.
Fantastic. So we'll jump right into our discussion. In recent years, there's been increasing interest in the effects of environmental exposures on the development of chronic rhinosinusitis. In particular, I think we're seeing more and more publications relating to air pollution, environmental and industrial disasters, climate change, and their effect on chronic rhinosinusitis and respiratory conditions as a whole. Your group at Vanderbilt has done some recent work in this realm with a particular focus on environmental pollutants. I was hoping that we could start our discussion with a background on the general state of knowledge kind of regarding environmental pollutants and CRS, and then also the Vanderbilt group's particular focus in this area. So why don't you give us a little rundown?
Well, I think globally, we are, you know, still kind of at a very early stage in terms of trying to understand the connection between, you know, air pollution and chronic sinusitis. But I think from a just an intuitive standpoint, you know, having chronic exposure to, you know, air pollution can certainly lead to epithelial barrier dysfunction. And we sort of all know that that's kind of that master trigger behind chronic sinusitis. And there's certainly other potential causes, you know, in terms of, you know, chronic infections or different bacterial toxins and, you know, inflammatory disease processes that can sort of also lead to epithelial barrier dysfunction. But I think that the role of environmental exposures has kind of been so far to the wayside. We've kind of always sort of thought about allergies and chronic inflammatory exacerbations and chronic infections, but really less so with environmental exposures. And so right now, I think most of the work has, you know, been done by a couple of groups, and I'll kind of highlight Dr. Ramanathan's group at Hopkins, who I think has done some really great NIH-funded work in mouse models, you know, essentially exposing mice to different, you know, particular matter substrates via exposure chambers, essentially, and has really seen elevations in particular cytokines, you know, essentially type 2 and type 3 cytokines in mouse models of chronic rhinitis and chronic sinusitis. And so I think our interest sort of was generated from some of that work that I think he had been doing and just trying to apply that to human samples and to see if something similar was going on in our patients as well. And so what we kind of proposed in some of our studies is to essentially use geospatial modeling to estimate particular matter exposures. And what that is essentially using these machine learning models that are able to take data from different weather sources in conjunction with PM2.5 monitoring stations, of which there's only a handful. So if you just use PM2.5 monitoring alone, you're going to get really crude measures. But a lot of the folks in the environmental sciences have sort of developed these really robust estimation models where they're accurate to about 0.75 kilometers squared. So you can get really, really granular with that. And we essentially wanted to see how things looked from our patient population with respect to their sort of cytokines in association with their estimated exposures about 1 year before surgery. So we were able to kind of marry that data together and use a lot of the data that we've archived over the last decade or so in our biorepository to sort of see how air pollution exposure could potentially be linked with inflammatory markers, but also quality of life outcomes. And so I think we've kind of done a host of different projects that have kind of looked at that and tried to ask different questions about where those two things might be kind of related.
If we maybe back up to a bit of a foundational level for anyone who's listening to the podcast and maybe not aware of what PM2.5 is and its significance kind of overall as we think about environmental pollutants, can you explain that a little bit for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a very broad sort of definition. So PM 2.5 is essentially any particulate matter that's out there that's 2.5 micrograms in diameter or less. You know, these are really, really sort of tiny particles. Another sort of PM that's often mentioned is PM 10 as well. And one of the things that's kind of interesting, and I think there's a adage in rhinology, it's sort of, okay, well, PM 10 gets deposited in the nose and PM 2.5 is for the lungs. And, you know, we should really be thinking about PM 10 versus PM 2.5. What's kind of interesting is the bioactivity of some of the particles is actually pretty different. So PM 10 is definitely, these are larger particles, are kind of almost like grains of sand, and they kind of have more of a irritant sort of exposure where, yeah, if it gets deposited in the nose, you're going to sneeze, you're going to, you know, feel like there's something in your nose. And we sort of think that, you know, there's been some studies that have sort of looked at PM 10 and our group has sort of looked at it as well a little bit. And it doesn't seem to have the same effect as PM 2.5, even in the nose. And what we sort of have been thinking about in terms of hypothesis for that is that PM 2.5 particles actually have a higher capacity to generate reactive oxygen species and kind of cause some direct chemical actions on the nasal epithelium that PM 10 seems to have less of. And so we sort of think that it's not just the deposition and the irritation from that. Like you've just got something on your nose. And if only we did sinus irrigations, you know, after any type of exposure, we'd be fine. But I think that there's also some rewiring that's happening on like a metabolomic level with PM 2.5 that sort of maybe leads to some of these downstream things. So that's kind of where things are hopefully headed in terms of our research program, in terms of like looking at that in a little bit more specific kind of detail. But yeah, these, you know, PM 2.5 sort of comes from, you know, multiple different sources, from fires and particle storms and car exhaust and industrial processes. So kind of being generated all the time everywhere for us.
Yeah. And then maybe because it is so small, can potentially, as you said, have a little bit more effect on triggering actual pathophysiology, kind of at more at the molecular or cellular level, sounds right, like. Right. That's a little bit about what you all were kind of investigating. And then also, as you mentioned, what the group at Johns Hopkins has been looking at under with Dr. Ramanathan. So let's kind of get into this particular study that we're talking about today. Can you talk a little bit about your overall aim in performing the study, the objectives, and what you hope to learn from it?
Yes, what we're talking about before, we sort of have this data on patients that we've sort of collected over the years that, you know, have really well phenotyped chronic sinusitis, as well as control patients that we recruit from skull-based surgery. And we have the PM 2.5 levels for each one of those patients for a year prior to their surgery date, as well as inflammatory cytokine markers. And essentially, the idea is to use something from the causal inference literature to try and simulate what a randomized trial of PM 2.5 exposure could look like. Now, obviously, this is something that would never really be able to happen, where, you know, ideally, if you wanted to see what the effect of PM 2.5 was and if it led to chronic sinusitis, you would get a bunch of healthy people and you would take half of them and give them a bunch of PM 2.5 for, you know, a year or two. And then you would see them back 10 years later and, you know, look at the rates of chronic sinusitis in one group over the other. And no IRB will ever approve that study. But there's ways that you can use sort of advanced statistical methods to try and simulate what that kind of would look like. And that was kind of the goal with this. And so the idea is that we have this data and we can use a lot of the baseline data that we have collected for these patients to try and match people together and try to, you know, essentially simulate the balance that you get with a randomized control study. So to kind of back up a little bit, the reason why randomized control studies are so powerful are because when you randomize people to a treatment, essentially over time, you have a big enough sample of patients, everything sort of gets averaged out. And so those two groups are going to look really, really similar. And so any kind of effect that you see on what you're measuring from the trial is, you know, most likely going to be the result of the intervention, because that's really the only thing that's different between those two groups. And so the kind of the goal of our study was to kind of look at some of these confounding measures that could potentially explain differences in rates of CRS and not CRS, and try to match those patients up front to that and kind of create these two sort of patient populations that are very similar using this matching algorithm. And essentially, instead of having two groups that are, you know, CRS control, you'd essentially have a low PM2.5 exposure group and a high PM2.5 exposure group, match them on all the other, you know, variables of interest like asthma and allergic rhinitis, and weight them equally in terms of gender and race and other kinds of confounding factors, and then sort of see what the incidence of CRS and not CRS are in those two groups, and then sort of use that as a proxy measure for, you know, what that PM2.5 might be kind of doing in those patients. So I think that was one goal. And the second sort of goal is to sort of compare it to other kind of known factors, such as, you know, asthma and allergic rhinitis that we know are sort of associated, and kind of see what the magnitude of the impact could be for PM2.5 compared to those, because those are sort of things that we sort of know and accept to be, you know, associated with chronic sinusitis. And then sort of a third sort of goal was to just kind of characterize what inflammatory cytokines might look like in a control population, because we hadn't done that before. So this was kind of our first study, kind of looking mostly at controls to kind of see if there was any, you know, interesting findings that that we noted in that population.
Yeah, so I think an interesting setup where, you know, there's some overall kind of clinical markers, there's some, you know, potential pathophysiologic markers, and then the component of, you know, pollution exposure, or, you know, as measured by PM2.5. So interesting setup. Can you describe some of the key findings of the study? What did this show you guys?
Yeah. So I think the take home kind of message. So we looked at the outcomes sort of stratified by patients with polyps and without polyps. And obviously, as a field, we're kind of moving beyond that into endotypes and more granular definitions. But, you know, I think in our prior work, we sort of saw the air pollution signal primarily in polyp patients and not really that strongly in non-polyp patients. And we wanted to kind of mimic that sort of setup from our prior papers. And we actually saw something similar in this study, where in our polyp subgroup, there was an odds ratio of about 7.23 for the development of chronic sinusitis in the high PM2.5 group, which was statistically significant. And it's comparable to the odds ratios that we saw in our same patients for allergic rhinitis and asthma. And those were about, I think allergic rhinitis was 7.73 and asthma was 8.7. So because of the methodology, and because we didn't sort of do that real randomized trial, you can't quite interpret these odds ratios like you would for a true randomized trial. But the relative measure compared to these other factors that we sort of know from really good studies done over several decades as contributing factors to CRS sort of puts that measure into context. So essentially, if you have a history of high PM2.5 exposure, your potential risk of developing CRS with nasal polyps is comparable to the risk that you would have if you had a history of allergic rhinitis or a history of asthma. So I think that's kind of one big takeaway from this. And I think sort of contextualizes that finding into some terms that I think we as clinicians are really familiar with. And you know, we're not really thinking about that. Like, oh, you have high PM2.5, you should be screened for chronic sinusitis. But if someone walks in and they just have asthma, instantly we're like, we want to, you know, put an endoscope in your nose and just make sure you don't have polyps, because we know that can kind of be smoldering in the background. They may not necessarily know about it. And we did not see that same sort of finding in CRS without polyps. And so for that, we did not see that statistically significant relationship. So again, it sort of seems to be more weighted towards the nasal polyp patients. And then I think the other interesting finding in terms of like what could be a potential mechanism for this kind of comes from the control data. So we actually looked at a panel of, you know, several different inflammatory cytokines. And the only one that was really statistically associated with PM2.5 levels was IL-10, and it was an inverse relationship, meaning that you had less IL-10 with higher levels of PM2.5. And what's interesting is of all the cytokines in our panel, IL-10 is sort of the prototypic anti-inflammatory cytokine. So it's, you know, in some ways protective in some contexts. So what we're kind of seeing is even in these healthy patients who don't have CRS, as they have higher PM2.5 exposures, it seems like their anti-inflammatory cytokines or their protective inflammatory cytokines are lower. And so we sort of think maybe that's, you know, the genesis, or at least part of the genesis of why there's this higher risk of chronic sinusitis and this, you know, hyperinflammatory state is because some of the counter-regulatory checks are maybe not working as well in that population. So why that's happening and how that's all connected, we don't know yet. And I think that's kind of where I think we're excited to kind of delve in the future.
Yeah, I would agree. I think, you know, that this work is a bit, you know, early, but exciting. And to really put this PM2.5 kind of exposure in the context of, you know, having the same kind of odds or risk or as allergic rhinitis or asthma. And especially if you think about it in the context of CRS with polyps, which is, you know, often a type 2 mediated disease, as are often, you know, asthma and allergic rhinitis. The story, I think, is an interesting one that I'm excited to see, you know, where it goes in the future. So were there, you know, of the things that you've discussed or maybe some other findings in the study, was there anything that you weren't expecting, anything that surprised you about this analysis?
Yeah. I mean, I was, I guess, secretly sort of hoping to, you know, see an effect in the without polyps group, because I think that's kind of one of the things that, I mean, I guess we kind of knew that based on our prior analysis, but I did sort of internally sort of think that there would be some effect on even, you know, CRS without polyps, because I think you are still having, I guess, to kind of back up a little bit, to me, it's not necessarily clear that chronic air pollution exposure should just kind of lead only to nasal polyp formation or CRS with polyps. Like, it kind of seems like it could set you up for just CRS NOS, you know, essentially. I mean, I think all of all comers. So I think that was, I think, a little surprising in the sense of seeing that. And then I also think that, and part of this maybe because we had a smaller control group, not seeing kind of some of the other, you know, type 2 or type 3 cytokines being elevated in the control group, I think that would have hopefully made kind of a more, you know, I guess, cohesive picture, maybe, if you're sort of seeing the anti-inflammatory ones come down, the inflammatory ones kind of coming up. I think part of that's probably a measure related to power, because we had about 68 control patients versus over 308 CRS patients. So I think there's that element to it. And I also think that one aspect of it could also be just the noise that's inherent in using like geospatial estimation versus direct measures. So one of the things that we're really interested in doing in the future is having wearable devices for patients to kind of directly measure, like, what is your unique exposure? And that hopefully will capture not just their ambient exposure, which is essentially what we're measuring, but also any occupational exposures or indoor air exposures, which are really important and also kind of underrecognized, but increasingly so. There was actually a position statement put out by the European Allergy of Clinical Immunology, which sort of talks about indoor air exposure and its association with asthma, and a really nice kind of overview of the literature that they just kind of put out in the journal Allergy a couple months ago. I encourage folks to kind of look at that if they'd like. But I think something that's more directly measuring a patient's sort of unique exposures, I think, is kind of where I see the research hopefully going in the future.
Yeah, I think that would be really interesting. I think, you know, it's certainly something that we talk to our patients about, and oftentimes they bring up, you know, potential exposures in their occupation or social context or home environment. So I think that it would be, you know, particularly interesting to be able to measure that on an individual level and potentially even pair that with the geospatial data that you've, you know, already kind of collected. So speaking of that sort of clinical translation of this work, how do we bring this knowledge that you've gained from this study into our everyday care of patients? Does it have distinct clinical applications at this stage, or where do you see that sort of going in the future?
Yeah, I think that it certainly helps us with counseling patients. At this point, there's certainly not a specific, you know, treatment that we can, I guess, you know, give to patients you know, particularly for this. But I think in my practice, I think that just having, you know, started looking into this research over the last couple of years, I certainly think ask and screen for, you know, potential exposures more during the history taken process, only to kind of see if there is some, you know, potentially modifiable aspect of their, you know, condition in the sense of, you know, okay, if you say, you know, work in a factory and you're kind of constantly being exposed to, you know, particulates, you know, are you wearing a mask, you know, at work? Are you sort of following all those OSHA guidelines that they're probably telling you to do, but maybe in practice people are, you know, kind of lax with, especially if they have CRS and just kind of, you know, using those as almost like adjunct kind of therapies for patients that have, you know, high exposures. I've been telling them to, you know, do a sinus rinse when they get home, you know, just to try to help, you know, reduce that burden. You know, I don't have a trial data to necessarily show that that's helpful, but I think that just from the data that we have so far, I think those are some early changes that I've kind of made into the clinical practice. And then my hope really is, you know, based on not necessarily this paper, but some of the other papers we sort of put out and some of the data from the Hopkins group as well, there is sort of this mixed endotype that seems to be associated with PM2.5. So it's not this pure type 2 disease process, but there also seems to be some type 3 inflammation kind of mixed in as well. And I think that's particularly interesting in the era of biologics where we have these really great medications that are just purely targeting type 2 inflammation. And so I think this could potentially be a patient population that maybe is less responsive to those biologic kind of therapies. And maybe these are patients that would benefit more from surgery or maybe from, you know, some future type 3 directed biologics or sort of other types of medications that may kind of help with, you know, reducing reactive oxygen species generation and that kind of stuff. So there's some interesting data in some other disease states where like curcumin or turmeric, essentially the active ingredient in turmeric seems to help with, you know, reducing reactive oxygen species generation in like airway epithelium, not necessarily nasal epithelium, but in some of the folks in the asthma world have sort of looked at that. So that's maybe an interesting, you know, future therapeutic that could be developed for something like this.
Yeah, I think you bring up some interesting points. You know, I feel like for those of us that practice in areas with a lot of environmental allergies and pollen exposure, I mean, I know that in my practice, I tend to be really, really good at telling people to, you know, wear masks during pollen season and make sure they do extra nasal rinses and all of those sorts of things. But probably also a good idea to incorporate, you know, potentially some of the that type of discussion into, you know, the occupational realm, or, you know, maybe monitoring air quality, you know, indices and things like that. So I think that is something that could translate into, you know, clinical practice and patient education and all of those sorts of aspects as well. So are there any other last comments that you have before we conclude?
You know, I think overall, I'm really bullish about this kind of line of research. I mean, I think it's really exciting. I think it's fascinating. And I think that, you know, I'm really excited to kind of see where it goes. And I think that hopefully just it sort of uncovers just another route through which CRS kind of develops. It's not, I think, the cause of CRS, won't sort of, you know, go as far as to say that. But I think that, you know, maybe another way that we have, you know, chronic epithelial injury, and then, you know, for somebody who's predisposed to sort of reacting to that, then, you know, could be a contributing factor, a really strong risk factor for that. So I'm excited to see where things go with this, and hopefully sort of leads to, you know, new understanding of, you know, why chronic nasal inflammation develops, which I think is always, you know, we're several decades into rhinology as a field now. I think that central question is kind of still, you know, we're getting a better handle on it. We know more than we did, you know, 30 years ago, but I think we still don't quite have that picture solved. And so I think it continues to be really exciting to kind of at least work on a piece of that and hopefully get some answers for our patients.
Yes, fantastic work. So I'd like to thank you again for joining me, Dr. Chaudhry. would really like to encourage our listeners to read the paper in IFAR if they haven't already. Again, it's long-term particulate matter exposure may increase risk of chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyposis, results from an exposure match study. And I also noticed that the paper is available in open access format, so that makes it very accessible. Again, thank you. This has been an excellent discussion, and congratulations to you and your colleagues on the publication. And thanks, of course, to our Scope It Out listeners. This is Sarah Wise for Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology, and I'm signing off.